Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Today on the Optus Sport Football Podcast, I'm joined by Spanish football expert Phil Kitromilides and journalist Michael Bailey from The Athletic. This week, we discuss the controversial refereeing in the Merseyside derby, whether Mikel Arteta has made the right choice in the keeper department, and Phil gets to big up Antoine Griezmann again. Hello and welcome to the Optus Sport Football Podcast. I'm joined, as always, by Phil Kitromilides. Phil, 12 episodes in, and this will be the first time we're not going to be talking about Ange Postecoglou, as only because they're playing tonight against Fulham. How do you feel about that?
That's what you think, Mark. But trust me, I'm going to find a way to get him in. We're going to have a good old Ange chat, obviously, because the mighty Spurs are going to win tonight and go 2 points clear at the top of the table.
Well, we've already talked about him, haven't we? So there you go.
Yeah, there we go.
Anyway, Phil, we're also joined today by Michael Bailey, who is a journalist at The Athletic and last week ranked all 20 Premier League stadiums in an article. I'm sure social media was in full agreement with you, Michael. Must have been. Must have been absolutely amazing. Everyone must have been, yeah, he's spot on there.
Well, first of all, great to be here. Thanks, guys. I mean, I'm not even sure I agreed with the rankings we came up with in the end, because we tried to make it as thorough and involving as many different people and aspects as possible. And when we totaled up the scores, and I was looking at those and thinking, Brentford up there, really? Ultimately, I think we had more than 500 comments on the piece on The Athletic, and I made sure I stayed clear of most of them because I didn't want to get too much stick for it. But it's all good value, and there's some wonderful places to come and watch football. So it was nice to flag up a few of those.
What was number one? Sorry, I didn't see the piece.
Oh, is that a spoiler? It was Spurs.
Of course it was.
Spurs. There we go. Of course.
Do you know who manages Spurs? It's this Australian guy called Ange Postecoglou.
I'm genuinely disappointed if we're not speaking about Ange, because I love him. I think he's brilliant. And I did when he was at Spurs as well. So, you know, I'm enjoying watching him flourish.
So obviously all the listeners out there, make sure you go to Michael's article on the stadium judging and where your stadium will rank in the Premier League, and make sure you do give him lots of stick if you're not happy with these results, because that's what it's about, right? We need to have the stick as well, not just all the good stuff. Let's start today with the sad news of Bobby Charlton's passing. He was died at the age of 86. He was a World Cup winner and a Manchester United legend. But actually, I'll go further and say he was a global legend. He was known throughout the whole of the world. Michael, can you give us a bit of a context to our Australian audiences on just how big of a legend, not just for Manchester United fans, not just in England, but all over the world, that Sir Bobby Charlton was?
Yeah, I think some of the statements after the news of his death broke, I think, it probably summed it up. We had Pep Guardiola talking about Bobby Charlton being one of the pillars of English football and summing up so much of what English football is and how it got to be this just wonderful sport of such great importance to this country, but, you know, watched all around the world. You also had Pelé, who described previously Bobby Charlton as the spirit of football. And I think that encapsulated so much of him in terms of what he was as a person, but also then his phenomenal achievements on the pitch. I mean, I'm 42 years old, so I know who Bobby Charlton is. You know, I've known his name, but it's almost taken this weekend for me to just, rather than take for granted he was a great player, just have a little look and just sort of refresh, I suppose, and just reaffirm so much of what he did that was incredible. When you break it down, he won the European Cup with Manchester United. He won the World Cup with England. So right there, you've got just emphasising his importance across the whole of the English game by being one of the World Cup winners from 1966. Manchester United, it was, you know, he was their leading goal scorer until Wayne Rooney overtook him recently. He was their all-time appearance maker until Ryan Giggs overtook him recently. He made over 600 appearances. He won United's first European Cup. But at the very start of his sort of professional career, he also survived the Munich air disaster. He was one of the key components of rebuilding an entire club that at that point there were suggestions the club may have to fold because 23 people died in that, including 8 of his teammates. The club was on the floor and it had to be rebuilt. And so not only did Bobby Charlton become hugely important in terms of the success they had, but he basically was one of those who rebuilt that club to where it could flourish. So I think what Manchester United would be without Bobby Charlton is one question. And as I said, you then factor in the fact that for England, he was a key player in one of the greatest sporting achievements this country has seen in any sport. I think that probably only just does it justice, really. And the other thing I would say is World Cup winner, European Cup winner. He also won the Ballon d'Or in 1966. There are only 9 players in world football that have won those 3 honours. And Lionel Messi only just joined that group after winning the World Cup in Qatar. So I think that says it all, really.
Oh, that was amazing. You know what? When you were talking about Sir Bobby Charlton and about Manchester United and about him being at the forefront of that rebuild and the club on its knees, the hairs on the back of my neck stood up. I got a cold shiver down my spine because you just think about the magnitude of Manchester United as we see it today. People, I think, certainly from the outside, I'm sure Manchester United fans know all about it and know very much down to the core how big a person and big a part that Sir Bobby Charlton had played in the club. So all I can take from it, I don't think I ever got the experience to meet him, but everybody, whoever spoke about him, even the tributes that are all flowing in there, everybody talks about the man himself and how an amazing person he was and the influence he had on so many people, whether it was David Beckham, whether it was Wayne Rooney. There were so many people who have come out and talked about that influence.
And I don't think you can talk about him without, as Michael said, mentioning the Munich air disaster, because that just conditions everything. And just imagine the mental impact that has on a person of being in a plane crash that kills so many people, that decimates your team. You lose teammates, you lose friends, and they're gone. And to build yourself back up from that and to build the team back up from that is just extraordinary at a time when obviously nobody was talking about mental health. Nobody was giving that kind of support. He got on with it with just the quiet grace and humility that came to characterize him. And I think that is a fundamental part of who Bobby Charlton was and helps us to understand what he went on and to become. And it just puts into context everything that he went on to achieve starting from there. That's where he had to start, and where he ended up was right on the summit. So just an incredible. And Gary Lineker tweeted saying, England's greatest ever player, the best ever Englishman to play football. And I think a lot of people would agree with that. I obviously never saw him play live. I'm actually reeling from the fact that, Michael, you said you're 42. You look really good for 42. But obviously, we didn't see him play live. But you go back and you watch him play, and it doesn't seem like too dated, like his style. He actually seems like he could have, I don't know if he could have fitted in nowadays to play, but he was clearly an exceptional player when you go back and you watch the old footage. So yeah, just the word legend genuinely gets used too much, I think, in football, but probably for Bobby Charlton, it won't get used enough.
Absolutely. A humble giant in terms of how he carried himself. And I think that is showing in the warmth of all the tributes. But you're right, Phil. I mean, the way he could strike a ball, watching these goals he scored, I don't know how you'd have felt facing him, Mark. But I mean, these were rifles. He could, such a true connection with what these massive balls of leather. I don't think I'd have fancied being a goalkeeper coming up against Bobby Charlton.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, there's absolutely amazing legends of the game, and he's certainly right up there with being one of the greatest ever, and such an incredible influence on the game itself, as well as Manchester United. Like I said, may he rest in peace, an absolute legend. Unfortunately, we've lost him to the game. Let's move on to the Merseyside derby. And of course, there's always controversy, or generally there's always controversy in a Merseyside derby. I think the scoreline in the end, Liverpool winning 2-0, you kind of think, it was a reasonably comfortable affair for Liverpool. But Michael, you covered it for The Athletic. And first and foremost, we've got to talk about the refereeing decision. And then the referees are really pretty much, well, bang in the spotlight this season. It's been a huge error the other week. And now we're talking about, it's a pretty big error as well, right, Michael? Not giving Konate a second yellow. That was clear.
it was strange watching it unfold in real time, because there was a pause before Craig Pawson booked booked Ashley Young for the second time, and you're like, oh, will he give him the leniency benefit of the doubt? Oh no, okay, and fair enough. And then with Konate's second yellow, you sort of sat there, and I just remember shaking my head going, he's not going to book him. And it was just like, oh, you know, but surely he will, though. Oh no, he's not going to book him. And you could just sense it. And then you could see how enraged Sean Dyche was getting about it. And actually, post-match, I thought you could tell he was still pretty riled. There was a deep emotion in him when you kind of probably want your head coach to be a bit more under control. It was simmering and he was losing his words a little. I mean, there's one element of that second yellow where it looks like it's possibly a little soft in real time. And you, if you sort of avoid this cynical foot, there's not a massive amount of contact, and you think, okay, maybe there's just enough there that sowed enough doubt in Craig Pawson's mind to not give it. But having set the bar previously, and then you see Akanji's second yellow for Manchester City and all those things. I mean, it is a second yellow. I guess it's just an element of the incident where I can kind of understand maybe why the referee just thought it wasn't necessarily, maybe that I can't remember who it was who went down, but maybe they'd made too much of it. But I mean, maybe at that point he should be getting help from his other officials, because quite clearly in the context of the game, I think, and the decisions he'd made earlier, he had to send Konate off.
Some of the words that Sean Dyche used to describe the decision: ridiculous, baffling and impossible. He was obviously clearly furious. I agree everything you said, Michael. I think that there is just about enough element of doubt in real time for the referee to think maybe it's not a hugely physical challenge. There isn't that much contact, but it was cynical, and it, you know, it probably should have been a yellow card. But I was rewatching this game because I didn't watch it live, so I watched it afterwards, and I obviously heard all about it. And when I see the incident, I was thinking, ah, right, okay. Yes, it probably should be a yellow card, but then I can maybe see why the referee didn't feel like it. It's not like a cynical hack. He hasn't gone in two-footed. He hasn't kicked him. It's a slight tug, lightest of tugs, and he doesn't think it's a yellow card. It conditions the game almost certainly. And that's why I think Sean Dyche is so angry, because it really would have leveled things up in a game that was... Liverpool were better. I think they were better when they had 11 against 11. They were obviously better 11 against 10. But it wasn't that Liverpool were completely steamrolling Everton. They had more of the ball. They were looking the more likely to score. But it wasn't as if Everton were really, really suffering. So, you know, that the sending off conditioned it, and they're not leveling things up with the red card for Konate, obviously made things even harder for Everton, which is why Sean Dyche was absolutely furious.
I think rightly so as well, because I think you guys have been a little bit fence-sitting, I think, a little bit, because I think it's a clear yellow card. He knew exactly what he was doing. He was slowing the play down. Everton were on the break. It is a professional foul. It has to be a yellow card, in my opinion.
It is. It's just not like a vicious one. It's just a very light contact. It's the lightest contact. So this is why the referee is thinking, maybe I can get away with not booking him, because it isn't an overtly violent action. But you're right. It's cynical, and it is probably a yellow card. Yeah.
So you think he's influenced in his own mind, the referee? There's a pattern. I actually think there's a genuine chance that he's influenced by already having sent one player off. Do I want to send another one off?
Well, then if he's thinking about that, then he probably would have thought, maybe I should level things up. No, I mean, if you're thinking, well, I've already sent one off, then
yeah, I mean, you could look at both guys
off. I could send this guy off. So,
yeah, fair call. Yeah, you could. Yeah,
I mean, it was a questionable refereeing performance. I thought, you know, my boy Kostas Tsimikas should definitely have been booked a few times, actually, because he was fouling left, right and centre. But yeah, you know, shall we talk about the game? Because obviously, you know, we talked about the referee, but let's talk about the game, because there was lots of stuff to talk about, wasn't there, Michael?
It was a cracking... Oh, no, hang on, it wasn't. It was an interesting game. It was not a particularly good game. In fact, I thought it was pretty drab. You're sort of tuned in for this big derby, and I know it was a Saturday lunchtime just after the international break, so maybe everyone was still a bit half asleep, but it did feel very half asleep. For a derby, I was like, come on. And I thought Liverpool were really poor, if I'm honest. They didn't seem to get the ball into the right areas. I thought Everton were really compact, and there just wasn't any room for Liverpool were trying to go around the outside a lot, and they couldn't kind of really find through balls to make hay sort of into central areas. So they were struggling with that. I thought Mo Salah looked sort of off it as well, which, I mean, a lot of these guys have travelled around a bit, so you can kind of understand that to a degree. But I think also Liverpool probably knew in the back of their minds that they would find a way eventually. And it felt like that kind of a performance, that it was kind of an efficiency there. And I think that ultimately proved right in the second half as well.
But for Everton and Sean Dyche, there must be a lot of positives in terms of going to Anfield, defensively looking impressive, even though their overall play maybe wasn't the best. But in midfield as well, they were very strong. Liverpool struggled to break them down for large parts of that game. So there's got to be, I would think, Michael, having watched that game, you'd be thinking for Sean Dyche, there's a lot of positives he'd be walking away from that game with.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think Everton are in too bad. I think they're probably lower down the table than they should be based on what they're doing on the actual pitch. I think they've been reasonably solid, and actually these games are not so much of their issues. I think Sean Dyche knows how to organise the team. They're not going to struggle to be up for a game at Anfield against Liverpool. And so there's definitely, I wouldn't say there was anything there that would derail them. If anything, they can, as you say, they can take a lot of encouragement for how well they defended, how they kept Liverpool in check for a lot of it. And they can actually say, you know what, that didn't help us. So in terms of refereeing decisions. So there's a lot there for them to work on, but it's trying to deliver those kind of performances and obviously take a few chances when they're playing teams from lower down the table, especially at Goodison Park. So I think once Sean Dyche has got over the disappointment and his own emotions, I think they'll feel that there's plenty to work off the back of that, I think.
I agree with Michael in that it was a flat game, and it was surprisingly flat. And obviously the lunchtime kickoff in the UK wasn't lunchtime in Australia. It was a good kickoff time in Australia, actually. Fantastic kickoff time. But it was flat. It was after an international break. And I just got me thinking about the Merseyside derby. I wouldn't have tuned into this game if I didn't know that we were going to watch. I'm going to talk about it on the podcast on Monday. I knew we were going to talk about it. It's like, right, I've got to watch this game. I've got to sit down and watch it. But otherwise, it is not a derby that grabs me and forces me to sit and watch it, because, yes, it's often quite intense. This one wasn't. It's often quite intense. There's lots of red cards. I think it's the fixture with the most red cards in Premier League history. There's lots of late goals as well. So it can be dramatic, but it doesn't feel like a fixture that usually provides high quality entertainment. It doesn't feel like a rivalry that is one that captivates you, because it is so one-sided at the moment. It was just a little bit disappointing for me as a spectacle, and this one was particularly disappointing because it was so flat. But it got me thinking a little bit like what the Madrid derby was. Obviously, I live and work in Spain and cover Spanish football. And for 14 years, Atletico Madrid did not beat Real Madrid. So that was an unbelievably one-sided derby. And then Atletico got their act together, in came Simeone, and they started winning. It's a bit like Barcelona against Espanyol. Not quite as bad, because Espanyol are in the second division now and Everton are not. But it does feel like it is so one-sided from a neutral perspective, from a global perspective. This isn't necessarily a fixture that everybody has to tune into around the world, because you kind of know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's the problem. I think everything else is there, right? So the emotion, the history, everything about the Merseyside derby is in place. It's that one-sidedness. It's the difference levels in the two different teams. And that's for me the overriding problem. Everton, I kind of think it's a derby. Forget about form. Anything can happen. Actually, no, Everton's just played like they have been playing the rest of the season. So,
but Everton are massive, Mark, aren't they? Like, you've played there. It's a huge club, massive historic club, huge fan base, fantastic stadium. So they are a massive club, which maybe we don't realise outside of Liverpool just how big and just how many people in Liverpool support Everton. They are huge. It's just we don't see that in the derby.
Anyway, let's move on. Let's talk about Chelsea against Arsenal. Not so much the game itself, but more about Mikel Arteta. Has he, which I think he has, I'm going to hold my hand up right now, I think he's backed himself in a corner. He's put all his eggs in one basket, and he's playing David Raya ahead of Aaron Ramsdale. For me, Michael, I think that's the wrong decision.
So first things first, this was a proper derby and a great game. I really enjoyed this one. There's something that really annoys me about this. It's not necessarily the Arteta's choice. Like if he looked at David Raya and thought, I'm getting him in, he's going to be my number one at some point, then great. The issue I have is that when he made the change, he came up with some ludicrous story about it being, oh, well, no, I'm going to change the face of goalkeeping here. I'm going to change my goalkeeper on the 60th minute, because why can't you change a goalkeeper? You can change any other position on the pitch. It's great to have two and we'll, you know, pick and choose and there'll be this one. None of that has happened. All he's done is drop Darren Ramsdale and then play David Raya and that's it. So, yes, in that context, I just don't understand why Mikel Arteta would say all that stuff publicly. I mean, I don't know if he said that to them both in private. I hope not, because if he has, he hasn't done that. And the worst thing I think you can have is a manager who isn't then honest. I was quite, you know, I was like, fair play, Mikel. If you really see that and you're going to bring Aaron Ramsdale in for this game and then you're going to play David Raya, then great. But actually all he's done is just kept David Raya in. He started making some, you know, errors and now he's getting scrutinized and his ball playing isn't proving as robust as it was supposed to, because that was the scrutiny that Aaron Ramsdale was under at the end of last season. And so you're right. He's now faced with a goalkeeper who's losing confidence in playing and another one who's been dropped and doesn't know when his next chance is going to come. And then also, if he does, how long is he going to be in for? And that seems like a ridiculous situation to have created when you've got two very good goalkeepers. These are two really good goalkeepers at Premier League level, I think, in my opinion. So I don't really understand it. Mikel Arteta has done a lot of brilliant things at Arsenal, but this, and obviously he's worked under Pep Guardiola, so he'll have picked up a huge amount from that. But I wonder if some of this is part of that overcomplication of a situation and creating something that just didn't need to be there. It will be really interesting how this plays out, certainly for the rest of this year and what happens from there.
If only we had a former Premier League goalkeeper on the podcast who could give us his take on this. Mark, tell us, what do you think? Why is it such a mistake from Arteta?
Well, it's only seemingly a mistake right now, right? Because of David Raya is struggling under the scrutiny, under the pressure. Look, you look at the second goal he conceded against Chelsea. He just looked like someone who's completely out of sorts because he was so far out of position. I've watched it a number of times on the replay and I'm just thinking, where is he standing? He's like so badly out of position. I get it if he tried to guess where the ball was going. You know, like sometimes you can sort of like think, right, he's going to whip this in. I'm going to be on my bike really quickly and I'm going to come out and take this cross. And I get that because I've done that before. But to be that far out of position, that's a confidence thing, because that's happened to me as well. When you know you get caught out of position like that, you know that it's about confidence and you're feeling like every little mistake that I may make right now is going to be in the spotlight and I'm going to be so much under pressure. And that's what's happening to him now. His strength, playing out with the ball at his feet, is actually becoming one of his weaknesses at the moment. And when you're that good with your feet, that's like you can't make mistakes there. And I know it's really harsh, because I'm of the opinion if that's your bread and butter, that's why you have become such a good goalkeeper. One of the big reasons is that you can only afford to make fewer mistakes than most other goalkeepers with the ball at their feet, because that's your strong point. That's your marketing sales pitch, right? So I think he's massively down on confidence. And I think all round, I actually believe that Aaron Ramsdale is a better goalkeeper. And saying all that, Mikel Arteta obviously has a way that he wants to play, which we all know that. He believes that David Raya is the one that's going to take the club further forward. So he's put everything on David Raya. And I've been in that situation before. It doesn't matter what you do. The manager is, in my opinion, has already made his mind up. And he has to say what he has to say. And there's no doubt that he likes Aaron Ramsdale as a person and as a professional, but he's got to keep him on board for as long as he possibly can, until such time as either he leaves or if he needs him. And if it keeps going with David Raya unable to continue with handling the pressure and making more mistakes, he's going to need Aaron Ramsdale sooner than probably he would have actually have hoped. So he's got to now use his managerial skills to keep them both on side.
I think it's very interesting listening to your expert analysis, because obviously I was watching the game and yeah, okay, the second goal, I think it looks bad, but then I watched it back and I didn't think it was that bad. And I was watching it on Spanish TV, and maybe because he's a Spanish goalkeeper, he got a bit of a pass from the commentator saying, oh no, it was, his position wasn't too bad. You know, that ball was going in anyway. It doesn't matter where he was. That ball would have gone in because of the way it was hit. Mark is shaking his head, and I agree with Mark because Mark knows about these things and me and the Spanish commentators do not. But I didn't think it, I don't know, it didn't strike me as a catastrophic goalkeeping display from David Raya, which is how it's being billed. I mean, he made that mistake when he passed the ball straight to Cole Palmer. He rectified really good down. He's really good at diving down at the feet. He had Nicholas Jackson through on goal, and he dived down really quickly as well and avoided... It didn't feel that bad. Yeah, the distribution isn't the level that it should be, that we've come to expect from David Raya, but it didn't feel as bad, Mark, and as gratuitous as the mistake for Robert Sanchez for the first Chelsea goal, which for me felt really, really sort of unacceptable in terms of a goalkeeper. It was a bad mistake.
Yeah, I mean, there's fine lines, right? Because Sanchez has made that mistake and got punished, and Raya has made the similar mistake. Actually, if anything, he made a worse mistake in terms of the ball he played.
Yeah.
But got away with it because he rectified it. He made up for it, which was brilliant. The recovery was absolutely brilliant. No doubt about it at all. But I think it's more about, you know, when you've got two top-class goalkeepers like that, right? And you're talking about the controversial decision to change him in the first place, to say that he's going to rotate the goalkeepers. First and foremost, in my experience and my opinion, that doesn't work. It only works for a very short period of time because you can't keep both happy. And you could find yourself in a position where both are horrendously out of form because of the lack of confidence, because neither knows who's playing, neither knows who the number one is. As a goalkeeper, it's so specialized, right? People talk about it all the time. Goalkeepers are different, special, protected, whatever it is. We train by ourselves and everything else. It's all true, right? So you've got to deal with the position differently. So Mikel Arteta talking about, why can't I make a substitution and change the goalkeeper in the last 15, 20 minutes of a game? I mean, call me outdated and old-fashioned. I don't see how that's going to affect the game. It's different. We're talking penalty shootouts. That's completely different. And I get the logic behind the penalty shootouts. But in terms of a game, in the last 15, 20 minutes, you want to change it for a tactical perspective. If you've got two different goalkeepers, if you've got a goalkeeper that's a traditional goalkeeper, takes crosses, you know, commands his 8-yard box and is just okay with his feet, but you've got a goalkeeper on the bench who is outstanding with his feet and maybe he has a slight deficiency in the rest of him, maybe. But we're talking about two goalkeepers who are both very, very good with their feet and are both modern-day goalkeepers. I don't see the difference.
Let's insist on the goalkeeper just a second, because we have to obviously talk about the game, but because it was about, you know, a tale of two goalkeepers almost. What did you make of Robert Sanchez, Mark, and that mistake and his general performance? Because apparently there are even Chelsea fans now suggesting that he should be dropped, and the substitute goalkeeper who I think they brought in from New England Revolution in the summer should be coming in. So what do you make of Robert Sanchez?
I just saw a headline today, Michael, from The Athletic, that that Sanchez has very, very big shoes to fill and they're still very much empty. Something along those lines. I mean, it wasn't exactly right, but it's like they're still empty. And absolutely. And I'll hold my hand up. I was very, very surprised when Chelsea bought him. I was. His distribution at times can be outstanding, right? I've seen it and thought, wow, that is on another level. The way he could side volley, his distribution was great. But since he's been at Chelsea, he has really struggled. He's really struggled. I think he's been found out a little bit in his deficiency as a goalkeeper. I think technically he is not up there with the likes of, say, Alisson, goes without saying. So there's a lot of parts of his game that I feel that are nowhere near the level it needs to be certainly historically a Chelsea number one. Well, we're talking about a different Chelsea, aren't we? We're talking about a Chelsea team that are mid-table. We're not talking about a team, I mean, their expectations are to finish the Champions League, but they're a Chelsea team that are mid-table. So I'm still very much on the fence about whether or not he's the right goalkeeper for Chelsea Football Club. Right, we talked about the goalkeeping situation, certainly at both clubs, actually, Michael. Let's talk about the game itself. What do you think of the game? Chelsea 2-0 up.
and then lose the lead and end up drawing the match? A bit of disaster for Chelsea, or is it kind of what we're expecting from Chelsea these days?
I think with where Chelsea are, they can still take a lot of encouragement from that. I think the way the midfield was really had a really good hold of that game for long spells, certainly once they were ahead. And I think they were doing a lot of good things, bearing in mind some of that front line was a bit makeshift. They're sort of playing with no properly recognized striker and these kind of false number 10s almost. And I thought there's lots of movement and fluidity, and they caused Arsenal loads of problems. I didn't really think Arsenal were at it either. So given some of the issues, you start reflecting on how soon it's still early is it is in Maurizio Pochettino's reign. I thought this was really encouraging. It was like a step on from some of the other progress they've made in recent weeks. I think that Arsenal also deserve a lot of credit because of the way they were given an opportunity, obviously. I thought Declan Rice's finish was still very good, by the way. And the way they then grasped that, there's a real maturity and belief in what they are doing. And I see a team there that is bigger in stature and belief than it was last season, even though they had a phenomenal season last season. So I think you have to factor that in. Chelsea aren't there yet. They're a younger side, loads of changes, new manager. They've got a lot of work to do. But I think once everyone sort of sat down and thought about it, I know it's obviously no one ever wants to throw away a 2-goal lead, but you can kind of go, okay, we'll take that. They've got some really interesting games coming up as well, so they'll be big tests. But I just think it was a real mark of progress actually for Chelsea, and I think they can take a lot of positives from it.
Best performance under Mauricio Pochettino. I mean, the first half, they started so well, and Arsenal didn't really know what to do. It reminded me a little bit of the North London derby actually, where I just didn't think Arsenal were in the game at all. And they were gifted a way back into it. On the Spanish TV commentators were saying, Chelsea are putting the game to sleep when they were 2-0 up. They were seeing it out. They looked comfortable. Arsenal didn't look like getting a way back in. And then Robert Sanchez hands them a way back in. But I didn't think this was a particularly good performance from Arsenal at all. Mental resilience to get back into it. A brilliant finish from Declan Rice. And an absolutely magnificent cross from Bukayo Saka for the second goal, because he was really quiet throughout the whole game. I mean, he barely touched the ball. And that's what big players do. You know, if they're quiet in one game, they can be decisive with a moment of brilliance. And he was. And Arsenal got something out of this game where they really probably shouldn't have. And that is the mark of a team that can go on and win stuff. But yeah, I think it's very positive for Chelsea. It won't feel like it having been 2-0 up. But we've seen that they are... they're things for them to build on, and they're looking much, much better now than they were at the start of the season, and they should go on and move well up the table and move into the top four, as I predicted brilliantly on the preview pod that they would finish top four. It's definitely going to happen. Probably not. But they do have a run of interesting fixtures coming up: the West London Derby, and then Spurs, and then Manchester City, and then Newcastle. So there are some really big games for Chelsea coming up, and maybe we'll have a clearer idea of where they're at with this development, and maybe they start getting some players back as well, because they have had loads and loads of injuries out. So in theory, overall, a positive afternoon for Chelsea, even though the result, the way the result came about will make it feel that it won't.
The Women's Super League was in action again this weekend with live coverage of every game, and our Women's Football Wrap show every Monday on Optus Sport. Let's see what Narelle Sindos and Michelle Escobar had to say about the last weekend before the international break.
Thanks, Schwartzy. Well, yeah, Michelle, we saw Caitlin Ford celebrated her 100th appearance for Arsenal, which is a huge achievement. And while we do want to talk about the positives mostly, we can't help but maybe focus on some of the negatives that are coming out of Arsenal, because they do provide us with a lot of storylines. And one of the players, I suppose, in question is Alicia Russo, and perhaps she's not living up to her potential there.
Yeah, I guess she's struggling a little bit to slot in. I mean, she did score a goal last week. We're probably being harsh, but there are high expectations of her. In this game, she had the second fewest touches of any visiting outfield player. And now that we've seen both Beth Mead and Viviana Miedema come back from lengthy ACL injuries, you just wonder whether Alicia Russo is going to keep her spot in the starting 11 once those two players are back to full fitness. But at the same time, you'd be wondering, well, Jonas Eidevall, he would have known that this was going to be the scenario. So how are they going to plan for this And we've seen so many other WSL teams, they've got so much depth. So how are they going to handle this?
Maybe Russo is feeling a little bit of the pressure and maybe the outside noise, because when they signed her, we know they've been wanting to get her for a while. I was expecting her to be on the score sheet almost every week. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, I think so. But it also got me thinking as well, with England, she was most effective during that Euros by coming off the bench, being that super sub. And at the World Cup, like, she was great, but it wasn't, I felt like it wasn't at the same sort of heights that we've seen her when she was in that Lionesses team that won the Euros. There are high expectations when it comes to Russo. And like you said, we'd be expecting her to be scoring goals, but maybe she just needs that time to be able to settle in properly, and she could be firing away before we know it.
Well, thankfully, Katie McCabe came to the rescue for Arsenal in their 2-1 win over Bristol. Both of those goals were absolute bangers, but they did concede, and it was pretty nervy for a while there. It was 1-1. And you just wonder, maybe the defence will let them down. They can't be doing this towards the pointy end of the season.
Yeah, that's right. They really have to get their ducks in order. I suppose we said the same thing last week. And then in this game, 10 of their 25 attempts were on target, but they couldn't capitalise on those chances. They also had 16 corners to none. So, I mean, don't want to be bogged down in the stats, but they're very telling that they need to be more clinical. Well, and they also, in defence, they need to be better.
Yeah, well, I don't know if we sound negative or what, guys, but yeah, what do you think of Arsenal's issues at both ends, I guess, of the field?
Yeah, it hasn't been a great start to the season for Arsenal. I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, knocked out of the Champions League in the qualification, which is a real bad one for Arsenal, considering they got to the semi-final last season. One of the issues I see with Arsenal at the moment is that Alessia Russo, phenomenal player. Really, really like watching her play. I don't think she's quite found her stride in this Arsenal. So, and that's a combination of the rest of the team struggling as well. The manager's made a lot of changes, changed the goalkeeper back and forth. Beth Mead and Vivian Miedemaert still not at 100% fitness level, game level. They're going to be massive. So once they get fit, they're going to change a lot for Arsenal. It'll be very interesting to see where they fit in. Jonas Edelvall has a big decisions to make. Russo, Mead, Miedemaert, where does he fit all that incredible talent in the side? When you add to that Ford, Little and McCabe going forward, I mean, it's a phenomenal squad when everyone's back to full match fitness. So there's a lot of work still to be done for Arsenal to get back into their stride. What we saw them, how we saw them play last season, certainly the levels they reached. So watch this space, and a lot of work still to be done. Let's move on to La Liga. And of course, let's allow Phil to wax lyrical about Antoine Griezmann again. Is there anyone better at the moment in European football at the moment, Phil?
Let me ask you first, Mark. Did you do your homework this weekend?
I did. I watched it.
Did you watch Girona? Always watch Girona. Did you watch Girona? Your homework is to watch Girona every single week.
That's the one thing I didn't watch. I watched Atletico Madrid.
Hashtag always
Real
watch
Madrid.
Girona, man. I'm trying to get the movement going.
Sorry.
Girona, they were 2-0 down at home to Almeria. They came back and they won 5-2. They're second. They're level on points with leaders Real Madrid. It's an extraordinary story. It's still going. I've literally been telling you and the listeners for weeks now, always watch Girona. They score lots of goals. They concede. They're very exciting. So always watch them. Hat-trick for him.
Hang on. Do I get a half a mark? Just
what's
quickly.
That?
I looked at the scores and saw Girona were 2-0 down. And then went, Phil is on. He's like, he's having one. Phil, always watch Girona. What am I going to watch them? They're 2-0 down at halftime. Oh, sorry, at home. I'm not going to watch this.
That's when you should put it on, because you know they're going to come back. That's when you should put it on. They've done it before this season as well. So anyway, onto Antoine Griezmann, who scored a hat-trick in Atletico Madrid's 3-0 win at Celta Vigo. Is he the best player in Europe at the moment? I don't know. But he is possibly the player that most managers would want in their team more than anyone else. So let me explain myself. I think he is the biggest team-playing superstar that exists at the moment, and maybe we've ever had. You look at his heat maps, you look at his touches maps from games, he's everywhere. And I mentioned this last week or a few weeks ago when we were talking about him, I'll mention him again. The work rate, for a monumental superstar like Antoine Griezmann, I think it's unparalleled. I don't think we've seen anyone like this. He doesn't do anything that's necessarily too eye-catching. So he's not necessarily about the dribbles, the flicks, the tricks. He's extremely efficient. Everything that he does is done, it's because it's needed. He's not a showy player, but he's got an extraordinary vision. He's got an extraordinary intelligence. He reads the game so well. He can score goals. He can make passes. He tracks back and makes tackles. He is the complete player. So when I say he's the player that most coaches around the world would want to have in his in their team, I think it's because of that. He can genuinely do everything. And this wasn't necessarily his best performance, wasn't necessarily Atletico Madrid's best performance, but he scored a penalty. He scored a the second goal is perhaps a little bit fortuitous, and the third is a really good finish. But
did he mean the second
goal? The second goal, I don't think so. I don't think so. Second goal, if you haven't seen it, he was bursting through on goal. He had someone in the middle, I think it's Alvaro Morata. He decides to try and pass it to Alvaro Morata, we think, with his right foot. He slips, and the ball ends up in the back of the net. So I think he probably didn't mean it. But listen,
really,
you make your own luck in this world.
It's really hard to tell whether he means it, whether he slips. It's so hard. I've seen it so many times. I'm trying to work it out desperately. And I also want to mention the first goal. My God, Celta Vigo's goalkeeper, Ivan Villa. Oh, my God. Like, I mean, it's just one of those ones. The simplest of crosses. And he drops it and then gives away a penalty and gets sent off. So I think that's really harsh. I don't think he should have been sent off.
Well, it was a pretty clear goal-scoring opportunity. It was an open goal.
But it's double jeopardy, right? So he's been. It's a penalty plus being a red card. I mean, I don't think... Yes, he was late. Yes, it was a penalty. 100%. But I don't think it's a red card. Michael, you're nodding your head.
No, double jeopardy was exactly what I was thinking. I think it's a bit different if you're an outfield player, I think, and you don't play the ball. But I think for a goalkeeper, what's he supposed to do there? I think the penalty is there for the foul. I don't think it should have been red. So.
Fair enough. Anyway, Vicente Guaita coming on as well to replace Villa, former Crystal Palace goalkeeper, and actually doing all right. Didn't save the penalty, but there's question marks now whether or not Rafa Benitez is going to have him as the goalkeeper for Celta. Quick word on Rafa. He's under massive pressure as manager of Celta Vigo. They brought him in, gave him a three-year contract. It's not gone according to plan. It's their centenary year. He was supposed to lead them to glory, and they're flirting with relegation. So big pressure on Rafa Benitez.
Just quickly, what's the overall perception of Rafa Benitez in Spain?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think there's a lot of respect for what he achieved a while ago. I think his tenure at Real Madrid harmed his view amongst a lot of people. Basically, in Spain, half the people support Real Madrid and half the people support Barcelona. It's more or less like that. And when you go to Real Madrid and you are unsuccessful in quite spectacular fashion, like Rafa Benitez, and you fall out with players and you tell Luka Modric, don't play that pass with the outside of the boot, people are going to question you. And I think he's been questioned. But there is still, you know, respect, genuine respect for what he achieved with Valencia. Remember, he won the league with Valencia. He won the UEFA Cup with Valencia, won the Champions League with Liverpool. That is not forgotten. But more recently, his more recent past is less glorious. And I think people are beginning to question him. So respect for what he's done in the past, but the present isn't particularly good.
I want to ask you quickly one more thing about Griezmann. Diego Simeone said after the game that he has to protect him, has to take care of him. Is it a case of, is it an age thing? Is it how good he's playing at the moment? Or is it finally Diego Simeone really, really like buying into him? Because I don't know, I always felt there was a love-hate relationship. He wasn't quite in the good books. What is it?
No, he's always loved him. He's always loved him because he's that kind of hardworking player. He's a really Simeone player. He's all about the team. He's not about the individual. And he has really loved him always, I think. I think he's got to protect him because he's 32. And there's just a temptation to play him every week because there's no one that can come into the team and do what Antoine Griezmann does. So when you've got a player like that, you want to play him every week, but you can't. Because you've got La Liga, you've got the Champions League, you've got the Copa del Rey, And there is a Euros coming up where he will be instrumental for France as well. Last season, you remember, first couple of months, the club were protecting him themselves by him having this clause from Barcelona where he couldn't play more than a certain amount of minutes. So he was coming on in the 62nd minute of every game for the first two or three months of the season. So that actually protected him and allowed him to be really good towards the back end of the season because he hadn't played too many minutes to begin with. But yeah, I think they do have to protect any player who's 32 and who is going to play a lot of minutes. You have to know when to rest him. But at the moment, it's really, really difficult to rest Antoine Griezmann because of what he's doing. Their partnership with Alvaro Morata seems to be flourishing as well. So, yeah, long may he play as many minutes as Simeone feels necessary because it's a great value for Optus Sport viewers to enjoy one of the world's best players.
And the next big game was Sergio Ramos against Real Madrid. I mean, Seville against Real Madrid. I mean, how good was Sergio Ramos, Michael? I mean, he's like it was almost like a vintage performance, wasn't it?
Exactly. I mean, the clearly the guy's a legend at Real, so it's... You just want to protect everything, which, you know, in fairness, I mean, Sergio Ramos strikes me as someone who can get quite wrapped up in things and, you know, get a bit overexcited. So, like you say, that kind of that balance almost says as much about how Real is sort of completely entwined in his being, I suppose, and everything he's been. And I imagine, I don't want to speak for him, but I can just envisage him wanting to show off the absolute best of himself in that game. Just what an opportunity to do it. Sevilla clearly had a difficult start to the season and been a bit all over the place from what I've seen. Phil will obviously seen a lot more, but I think he'll have just wanted to show the very best of himself and it can't really lose in that situation, providing he does it. And that showed great discipline. And also those elements that you love to see from Sergio Ramos as well.
It was a very Sergio Ramos performance, it has to be said. I mean, it had everything, goal line clearances, dramatic late headers. And it was billed, as you said, as severe Sergio Ramos against Real Madrid. It's hard to overstate the figure of Sergio Ramos here in Spain. He is... almost been like a cartoon character. When he was at Real Madrid, he was this sort of superhero central defender throwing himself on the line, scoring these late goals, bare-chested, tattoos, rolling sleeves up. Sergio Ramos comes to save the day. And he left in quite painful circumstances. And he hadn't played against Real Madrid for, I think it was 18 years. So this game meant a lot to him, I think. And you could see that. And after maybe a slightly nervy first 10 minutes, he was actually really, really good. It's his best performance for a long time. And I think there's also in the back of his mind, he wants to get back into the Spain team as well with the Euros coming up. He's got the all-time caps record in his sights. And he thought he was out of the Spain national team set up. And he might be back in if he keeps playing like this, because it was a really Sergio Ramos performance. Sevilla didn't win the game, but nor did they lose it. And I think a 1-1 result is pretty good for Sevilla. Not so for Real Madrid, who were absolutely furious with the referee stopping a counter-attack, which ended up in a Jude Bellingham goal. Had to mention Jude Bellingham. We're you know, a good way into the podcast and we hadn't talked about him, so had to mention Jude Bellingham as well. He scored a brilliant goal, but it was ruled out by the referee, who had stopped the move because one of the Sevilla players was down injured, and he really could have let it continue and maybe then the Sevilla player could have got the treatment he needed. But anyway, Real Madrid not happy about that. And when they drop points, they often aren't happy with the referee. So let's put it like that. So
let's move on to Barcelona. And the superstar kid, superstar factory continues to move on and produce unbelievable players. Phil, talk about this one. They needed someone to come on late, 17-year-old. I'll let you pronounce his name because I'm struggling.
Marc Guiu. Yeah, I mean, there is actually a factory just on the outskirts of Barcelona where they make these talented wonder kids. You can go there, you can do a tour. There's a little production line. They put the limbs together, they pop the head on, and they put them straight into the dressing room for the scrutiny of the world. Obviously not, but they do have La Masia, which is the world-renowned youth academy, which has been producing world-class players for some time. I don't know if Marc Guiu is going to go on and be a world-class player because he's only 17. The thing is with these players that have made the jump, because it's so eye-catching, because they're so young. Marc Guiu was 17 years and 291 days old when he came off yesterday and scored after 33 seconds of his debut. It was the only goal of the game. He scores the winner against Athletic Club, and everybody's going crazy. He's played once for Barcelona's B team. He's playing for their under-19s at the moment, and it's the same jump that Lamine Yamal has made, that Ansu Fati made, that Gavi made as well. These are players that have gone from the under-19s straight to the first team, and it is a massive, massive jump. The under-19s playing regionalised youth divisions, and then to go from that to the first team, to playing in the Champions League, to playing in La Liga, it's an enormous jump. So I don't know if Mark Yu is going to go on and be a Gavi or be a Lamine Yamal or Ansu Fati. It's difficult to know, but he took his goal very, very well yesterday. There was wonderful scenes of his mum absolutely crying her eyes out in the stands after him scoring. It's an incredible story. I mean, he's the quickest player to score on his debut, 33 seconds. And like I said, let's see if he goes on to become a superstar. We shouldn't get ahead of ourselves. And he was only in the team, you know, only in the squad, because Robert Lewandowski is out injured and they didn't really have any other options. The squad had been decimated by injuries, you know. No Lewandowski, no Rafinha, no Pedri, no De Jong. They were lacking in options. So when you're lacking in options, and this is something that Xavi has done a lot, you go to the youth academy and you bring in youth players. And he has done that to his credit. Throughout his tenure, someone who knows La Masia, who came through La Masia, who trusts La Masia, and got him out of a hole last night against the Athletic Club because they hadn't played particularly well. Mark Yu scoring the only goal of the game.
Michael, 33 seconds on the pitch, second touch, because he takes the first touch to set himself up and then places it past the keeper, Unai Simon. Can you remember a better debut? Because imagine his stories. If nothing ever comes of his career, imagine the stories he's going to be telling in the pub one day when he's like 45, 50 years old. 33-second debut, two touches, balls in the back of the net for Barcelona. We win a game.
I mean, he's got a whole career ahead of him now of being able to sit down with people and going, oh, that took you 33 seconds. So I'll tell you what I did in 33 seconds. Like, I think it was a brilliantly taken goal as well. It was a bit of a shame for Unai Simon, because I thought he made some really good saves over the course of that game, and it just kind of slipped through him a little bit. But I suppose when you come in as a youngster into Barcelona, you know you're surrounded by such good players that you do have that kind of freedom to make a real impact at such a high level, and then that must open so much in terms of what you can then go on to do. But it doesn't in any way guarantee that you're going to be able to do it. So that's like when Ansu Fati's obviously has done that, and now he's trying to rebuild something at Brighton. So it's a great moment, and it's something to really build off. But you know, it's obviously just a start. It is really interesting with Barcelona, as you were saying, Phil, that Barca have got so much, so many players to come back, and so much that they can kind of improve in terms of getting those players back and finding some momentum. With Real, it feels like it's a bit stuttery and it's not quite clicking yet, and you're not quite sure if they're going to have that same ability to go through the gears or whether, you know, they've got as much, as high a ceiling maybe as Barcelona have this year. It'll be really interesting to see how that pans out.
I was just trying to remember, and I don't know about the best debuts, but I think Jonathan Woodgate did a reverse Mark Yu on his debut for Real Madrid, when he scored an own goal and got sent off on his debut.
He scored an own goal, and then he scored up the other end of the pitch. So he scored twice on the day, an own goal, scored, and then got a red card. Guys, all right, I'm going to put you in the spot. I mean, Phil, you were talking about Real Madrid. It's their title. They're going to win the league. There's no one else really going to be anywhere near them. What are you saying now?
I'm saying, Mark, that they are currently top of the table at the moment. So, they are leading. But it's going to be very interesting next week, because we've got El Clasico next week.
Yeah,
Barcelona against Real Madrid, biggest game in world football.
Before we get to that, though, who's going to win the title? Come on, don't dance around it. Who's going to win? You said Real Madrid at the beginning of the season.
I was leading up to that. Okay. I was leading up to that because the Clásico often goes a long way to deciding the league title in La Liga, because these other teams essentially drop, you know, very few points in other games. Barcelona haven't lost yet this season. They're the only team that hasn't lost in La Liga. So I think we'll get a better idea after next week's El Clásico. I'm sticking with Real Madrid. I predicted at the start of the season. I'll stick with them now. They're currently top, but you know the Clásico is going to be massive next week.
Michael?
I think it'll be a draw at the weekend, and then Girona will win every game for the rest of the season.
Vamos. That would be amazing. If that happens, wow. I don't know what I'll do on the podcast, but I'll do something special if that happens.
Let's talk about, you mentioned El Clásico. You and I are going to have a bit of a trip coming up. We start on, I arrive in Barcelona on the Friday. We're going to go to El Clásico. Then we're going to the Manchester Derby the next day. That's just going to be incredible, isn't it?
It's our magical weekend away, Mark. You know, it's going to be really special. I mean, two of the biggest fixtures in world football, back to back, Clásico and then Manchester Derby at Old Trafford. I'm very excited because I've never been to Old Trafford, been to the Etihad, never been to Old Trafford, so it's going to be quite an experience on that level. And it's going to be really interesting to compare as well, going from one game one day to the other game the other, compare and contrast the experiences of being at these two massive derbies, massive rivalries. So yeah, really looking forward to it, and hopefully we'll produce some interesting content for OptusSport along the way.
Yeah, it's less, the derbies are less than 24 hours apart from each other, and it's obviously all on OptusSport. We're doing it for OptusSport. Michael, what do you reckon? Like, I mean, it's pretty cool, right? Or would you be just going, my God, is that like, can you do it in less than 24 hours and that's going to be exhausting?
Oh, no, it's definitely, well, it will be exhausting, but that's just the price of magic times, isn't it? It's going to be fun. I mean, Barcelona is a brilliant city, first and foremost. I have been to the Nou Camp before. Obviously, that's sort of a heap of rubble at the moment. So it'll be quite interesting, to be honest, to experience El Clásico at the Olympic Stadium and how that works, because it's probably a little bit alien, I suppose, for everyone. So that will be, but yeah, it's a wonderful city as well, and you'll have lots of fun, I'm sure. Old Trafford is, I mean, it ranked higher than I was expecting on the old stadium rankings to bring us all full circle. And you know, there are some tired edges to Old Trafford now. I think it suffered a distinct lack of investment in the last decade or so, but it is a proper place to go. It's a magnificent place to go and watch football. It just, I mean, you'll have played there, Mark, obviously, and you know all about it, but the way that it's all up there looking down on you, and there's so much to see around the stadium as well. I mean, we've been talking about Bobby Charlton, obviously. There's so many tributes around the stadium too. So, yeah, fill you in for an absolute treat, and then you get to watch two fantastic games of football as well. It's going to be, I'm jealous, let's be honest. Enjoy it.
Looking forward to it. Can't wait. And of course, you'll be able to catch up on all of our adventures on OptusSport and all social platforms, of course, throughout the weekend. I'm sure Phil and I will find a way to entertain ourselves and have a wonderful time. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. Guys, that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks a lot, Phil, as always, for joining us.
See you next week, amigo.
Absolutely. And Michael, thank you very much for your debut on the OptusSport Football Podcast. Absolutely enjoyed having you on it.
It's been a pleasure, gents. Really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Drop the skincare regime, Michael.
I'll DM you, Phil. Don't worry.
Cool.
I think there's a bit of jealousy going on there from Phil. I mean, Phil is always a very well-manicured man. You can see. I mean, last week, I thought he was outstanding. He looked very crisp, very well-manicured. This week, he's looking a little bit jaded. I don't know. Maybe you just got straight out of bed. I don't know. You haven't done your hair this week. I'm not sure. But still, your beard is looking immaculate, Phil. That's where I always look at and go, your beard is right up there. Right
I'll
up there.
Make sure I'm in good shape when I meet you next week, Mark.
I can't wait. You're not getting much else from me, mate. This is me. I don't change very much from this. Anyway, reminder that every game of the Premier League, La Liga, and the Women's Super League are all live and exclusive on OptusSport. Thanks for your company on the OptusSport Football Podcast. See you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.